Little late start. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Lisa Lorraine Smith, the Chief Program Officer here at the network, and I get the honor of running these affinity groups and getting to know professionals in the field throughout North America and Israel. And it's really an honor and a privilege to be able to do that. And I really get to work extremely closely with Marissa Gordon, who is the co-chair here from JFS in Boca Raton, and with Debbie Falk, who is your other co-chair, and she's with JFS of Cincinnati. And they're going to take it away, but they're our co-chairs. And what Debbie and I were talking about before you came on is how do we get more people to know about this affinity group? And I don't know if any of you are coming to the conference. Has anyone signed up for the conference? Okay, we have a few people. Okay, we have a few people. So I was saying to Debbie that there's opportunities for private chat. And my job during this conference is really to reach out to people who I've never seen before, names I don't know, and see what their titles are. And let's say there's someone in home care, I'm going to reach out. Did you know about this group? But if you all want to do the same, if you just happen to be in the in a meeting with someone and you don't know them, you could also do the same thing. We've got this group. It meets every 6 weeks, every 2 months. Join us, something like that. Contact Lisa, right? And my name will be there as well. So that's my big plug. And take it away.
I'm just wondering about how to get more Canadian JFS home care people involved, because we just have like Montreal, Vancouver, and Edmonton, right?
Potentially, Winnipeg and Toronto don't have a home care administrative kind of service,
Right.
but
What
they
about
might.
Ottawa? What about Ottawa? I thought
Ottawa.
Ottawa.
Well, you know what, Elaine? Why don't you write? I'll look it up and see if we know who they are. I don't know. We invite everyone to everything.
Right.
I don't
For
know who
any
they are.
agencies that we can find out that do have home care that aren't participating, we can just draft a letter letting them know about what we've done the last year and a half, and inviting them to join us, encouraging them to join us if we can do that. I mean, do we have a
I
list,
can
Lisa,
do
of the
that. I mean,
agencies that, right?
I could do that if I know who they are. See, I can just tell you one thing and then we'll move on, is that we just got this new database. My goodness, you guys all know. And we're just, and we got it during COVID, right? So we haven't been able to, one of the goals of the database is for agencies to put in all their information, right? So your CEOs or your COOs or whoever are going to put in all the information. So we're going to know what agencies have what. And then in the flick of a, click of a whatever,
You do a search,
I
yeah.
can do a search for home care administrators and their titles and send an email to them. But at this moment, we only have who has stepped up to be in these groups, right? So we don't have other information as we speak, but we're hoping to get it, hopefully within the next year. But right now, this is what we have.
Yeah, so we'll use the conference as the opportunity to recruit as individuals if we can, or in the sessions that we're in, and then we'll go from there. I started just by asking before everybody arrived, Lisa, how do we grow this and make folks know that we're, since we're not presenting at the conference, there's no home care presentation per se. How do we build our identity among the other groups, because I think we're also one of the newer groups as
You
affinity group.
also are one of the smaller groups because I don't think as many agencies throughout the network have this service, right? So in a way, it's really great because you every small group is a gift. And we did evaluations and the majority of people really got a lot out of the home care administrators group. They enjoyed the conversations, right? You don't feel like you're not heard because you have plenty of opportunity to talk because there aren't a lot of people necessarily.
Well, it's more interactive, yeah. Other groups that are larger are more presentation based than like.
Right. And these larger groups we've now started because now I've learned how to do it and it's so easy. Who knew? Breakout rooms, right?
Breakout
So
rooms
when
is
you
great,
have
yeah.
65 people in an affinity group, I can break people out into eight, rooms of eight, which is, what we do, and then come back together. So there you are.
Okay.
But you've got a lot to talk about today. So
We
you're
do.
here. Let's talk.
Debbie, I can or you can give the little intro.
Start.
Second. Well, we thought that it's a couple of sessions ago, we thought we would discuss this topic and we had so much to talk about. I think we didn't really get to it, but the for us, I know the issue of caregiver shortage and the desire on the part of clients to limit the number of caregivers that are taking care of them because of COVID has increased the occurrence of overtime, and different agencies handle that problem differently. Some all have policy where they always charge the client. Some never charge the client. Some charge the client sometimes. I'd be interested to hear also, I don't know, in Canada, if that's an issue, like every, you know, state to state, it doesn't vary that much. Basically, it's labor law that over 40 hours, you have to pay time and a half. Registries are able to get around that. And some choose not to, actually. But anyway, it's a big topic. For us, it's presenting itself more and more. And the most recent problem is really for us, the caregiver shortage. So it's not even only clients not wanting multiple caregivers. It's us having to use the same caregivers on multiple cases for as many hours as they're willing to work because we don't have enough caregivers. And then another part of our conversation was also going to focus on bonuses or raises or anything we're doing in our agencies to recognize the risk that caregivers are taking or the tough year that they went through, et cetera. So Debbie, please go ahead and add anything that I might
have. No, that sums it up perfectly. So if we just want to do it even as a round robin, how everybody's doing, and then B, talk a little bit about what you do for overtime, how you manage overtime, how you handle overtime, how you handled, and I actually think this came up between Marissa and I like back in November when we were all planning our holiday bonuses.
Right, I remember we've been wanting to talk about this for some time, but it always gets pushed back because of, you know, COVID, of course, has taken over.
So we're relatively small groups, so we should be able to cover a lot of ground today. So whoever wants to start, or I can go first and just tell you sort of, I guess I'll tell you what we're doing and then I'll let somebody else go and tell us how you handle overtime bonuses. So we're seeing caregiver shortage for sure, and overtime is an issue. Things are improving a little bit for us. We've had more applicants and have been able to do that by really targeting the kind of the hours that we want when we advertise. So we're looking like for, here's the perfect third job for you. You know, you can work 5 to 8 every day, you know, after your shift, you know, whatever. We really try to target it so that we get what we need in each application pool. But we were having a huge overtime issue. I thought my CEO was gonna blow a gasket on what we had spent on overtime because they want either the same caregiver every night, which nobody can work that much, or they want to limit the number of people. So, you know, because we've been able to hire a few people, we've been able to lessen our overtime by almost 50% since December, November, December, but it's been a constant battle. And every week I hold my breath until our overtime number pops up at the end of payroll. So to see what it's gonna look like. So I'm up for any suggestions or ideas you all have. We did do bonuses at the end of the year. We ask families for donations for bonuses. And then we match it. And so whatever, with a goal of a certain amount, it's not really matching. I know what I want to pay everyone, what I want to give everyone at the end of the year. But if I have the opportunity, families always want to give gifts. And so this allows them to make a donation to a group gift. And then it helps supplement what we pay everyone.
How much did you raise that way? And how many people did you give it to?
We were able to give everybody $150 bonus in the week before Christmas. So it's not a lot of money, but it's gifts or it's cover. It's something they don't necessarily expect. And when I started, we moved it like a certain rate for part-time. Like I think we were giving part-time folks 100 and full-time folks 150 basically, or we did some calculation like that. So families like it because they want to give gifts and they know they're not supposed to tip or give gifts. And this gives them the opportunity to feel like they're contributing. They still might buy dinner for them and for their parent and the caregiver to have a special holiday dinner or something like that, but this gives them the opportunity to do that.
Did you do it by sending out a letter and giving them like a suggested range?
We didn't even give a suggested range. We just, I can send a copy of the letter. We can put it into the, it was able to start because when we started, we were part of another nonprofit that had a foundation. So the gift came through the foundation. We've just adopted it anyway. And I just send a special return envelope that's marked. So I know that it's meant to be a gift and not, a payment towards a bill or something like that. So we we mark the envelope and return it. And everyone seems very grateful. Not everybody participates, obviously, but those that do are grateful for the opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what the average amount was or what the range
in? I would have to look. I don't even think I've seen what the total was, honestly, because we've been in audit for the last month. So, it's a few thousand dollars, whatever it comes. I mean, I have a much smaller.
I meant per client, like a family. What was the average amount a family contributed?
When I used to do it for my, it's about $200 to $500, depending. Wow. It depends also because if you think about it, like a 24/7 client, which we have a few of, they want to make sure everybody gets a piece of the puzzle and they know it's divided among everyone and they're grateful and they can't give me gifts or my
manager. Right. That's interesting.
Their way of thanking everyone. So that has worked for us. I find as long as you send the letter out before Thanksgiving, it depends on when, not when Hanukkah is so much. Usually I send it out before Thanksgiving so people have time to talk with their siblings. And because also you're often talking three siblings want to contribute towards moms.
That's true. Does it mean that, do they know, are you, and if it is the case, do they know that you're going to pool all the money?
Yes,
or do they, so they know it's not necessarily that it's all getting directed to their caregiver.
Right. The letter.
They're okay with that. All right.
Yeah, the letter states
that. I was going to say, we need to see that letter.
Yeah.
So
I'm just wondering, Debbie, how that works with competing with the agency's fundraising campaigns. Because at JFS Vancouver, we have several campaigns during the year. So if we put that out, like you'd have to kind of time it. If we put that out at the same time, they have their friends and family campaign, their innovators lunch, their Passover in a box, the Rosh Hashanah in a box.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it depends on whether your home care
is through your agency or separate. Yes. Like we're separate.
Right. So first of all, it's separate. I don't reach out to JFS and ask for donations. I'm asking specifically the family members of our clients. And sometimes the clients too, if they're financially able, want to give a gift, and especially in COVID, they couldn't get out to the store to buy a box of candy, so they would write a check. And the check is much more meaningful than the box of candy in a lot of ways. So the letter is very specific, and we have it worked out with our development director. Like she knows the third week in November, a letter comes from StartPoint just to StartPoint client families, and you would just work in that window.
That's what I want to say to Elaine, and I know Tatiana wants to talk, because I think that that's such an important piece that you could get your own. Why can't your department get its own little campaign at a certain time? And maybe it's February. I mean, I'm making up a day, and so advocate for that, because that's a great idea. And then you have money at the end to, give bonuses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's great. Tatiana, go ahead.
Yeah.
David, can you clarify if the bonus went as an addition to the salary and if it was taxable then in this way? I believe that was kind of a discussion that we had about providing bonuses to our workers, and we thought that that might make their salary go to a different range, and that would kind of, they have to pay the additional taxes on this. How did you go with us?
Yeah, so what I do is I tell my finance director how much I want them to have after taxes. So I tell her I want it to be $150 after taxes, and she does the math to figure out. So maybe the amount is really $167.34,
right,
and it comes out to $150 after taxes or whatever all their deductions are. I also think it's run as a separate check and not added to their regular paycheck. So it's like a separate deposit. But
would it be like better, let's say, if the money that you fundraised or had an extra in your fund just to buy gift cards for them?
That's how you avoid the taxes.
Yeah, so that's what I was kind of thinking.
Like in Canada, we may have different tax laws than in the States, but I just want to tell you when it comes to my turn to speak, that's a way, Tatiana, to avoid the taxes.
Yeah. So I think we've done both in the course of the history of the organization. We used to give them gift cards at Thanksgiving and then a bonus at Christmas. And, you know, there we have laws about and limits to gift cards and how much you can gift. So there's also limits there in terms of how much you can gift someone before they're taxed. And so, and unfortunately, sometimes like we're talking about the overtime, sometimes we have to use gift cards as a bonus to get somebody to pick up a shift or, you know, to incline them. So we're very careful about how much we spend on that as the year progresses.
Okay, I guess I can go next. In terms of bonuses, we applied for a couple of grants, which we got, and we were able to give two bonuses this year during the COVID year. I think full-time staff got around $300, and then we broke it down. You know, somebody who's only works 8 to 10 hours a week, somebody who works 15 to 20, then, you know, 20 to 30, then 30 to 40. So we broke it down, but the people who work full-time got around $300 twice during the year. And with respect to overtime,
how could you afford that? How did the agency afford that? Did they raise money for that?
We got two grants.
Oh, you got two grants. Did you just tell me that?
Yes.
And I missed it? Okay.
Yeah, we got two. That's the only way we would be able
to do
that. For overtime, we always charge the client. And we have our labor standards laws are from after 8 hours, it's time and a half. And then after 12 hours, it's double time. So we even get into that. The only time our program would absorb it would be if it was our fault in a way, like if, you know, somebody got stuck on the bus and the bus broke down and we had to have the person stay longer than, you know, that puts them into overtime, then the program would absorb it. But if the client is saying, oh, I don't want to have so many people coming to my home, or I really like so-and-so, yeah, I want her to work 12 hours instead of 8 hours, then they pay it. The client or family pays it. And just to tell you, to add to our chaos, this not only do we have a pandemic, we're moving. we have to move. And so we're moving and our whole agency is going to be shut down for a month. So we can't do PPE, we can't do anything. So it's going to be crazy. It's going to be so crazy. We're all going to be working from home.
Okay.
But the things that you normally do in the agency, like packaging PPE and stuff like that, we're not going to be able to do. So we have to do as much in advance of the move as possible. It's just
I want to hear more about that, Elaine, eventually, because we're also getting ready to move and have looking at properties since the beginning of January, since literally the day we came back from vacation. We've been nonstop looking, and it's the whole agency, but
it's the whole agency, but we're splitting. The first time in our history, the agency is splitting into two. So we're not going to all be together. So.
Why? Because of it's more affordable.
The rent. Rents are so high in Vancouver. It's crazy. It's so crazy. And we're not even going to have our own desk anymore. We're going to have a floating desk. So you have to bring all your things in a bag or whatever.
That's tough. That's like when I was an intern, a social work intern.
Any desk at all, any computer at all, you have to coordinate with everybody. You know, who's going to get which desk. Yeah, spaces.
Well, you'll figure out a system. There'll be some sort of big.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. We'll figure it out.
But that's tough. It's different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Elaine, can you share where the grants came from?
I didn't do the grants. The director above me did the grants, and I think it was Van City. Here, Van City is very into nonprofits, so you have to find a bank that really supports nonprofits, and I think that's how they got it.
Okay, thank you.
Natasha, you were going to say something?
I was going to jump in on the conversation. Marissa might have already given what we work together. So she might have given some information on what we're doing right now.
Do you work with?
Marissa.
Oh, okay.
I usually sit with her in the office. So I'm on my own today.
Okay.
I actually run the overtime reports. And I think at this point, it's more case by case. And we try to just really understand whether overtime is something that we have to put in place because of our shortage, and we don't want to put that on the client and bill them overtime that they didn't necessarily ask for. And so in those cases, we might allow the overtime and not bill it and keep that case in the back of our mind until someone does become available who wouldn't be at overtime, and then make a change. But we've also been a little bit lenient and forgiving in the past. We have the clients who, like Elaine said, want the overtime. They want the caregiver. They want them to work 5 days a week, even if they're working 12 hours a day. And so we have become a little bit, we have to bill those clients, go back and bill those clients if there's overtime. Another thing that we started to do, not necessarily overtime, but with COVID, and I don't know if some of you have experienced that as well, caregivers are asking just to make a higher base rate. It might be because of the client's situation or what they're being offered out there. That's one of the things that Marissa and I have been researching, is what agencies are charging these days and what they're paying their caregivers, because a lot of caregivers are coming back to us and telling us that they're being offered competitive rates that are above what they were being offered a year ago. And so depending on the case, we might not have to do that. But if it's a case where we can foresee that we're going to have to pay a caregiver more, then we've given ourselves a little bit of wiggle room with clients during our intake. And we might tell them, instead of offering them what the flat rate is, that there's a little bit of a scale there. If we have to pay a caregiver $2 more, then we might bill the client the $2 more, so that we don't come out losing. And that's also case by case. We don't want to deter clients, but it's just something that we're still exploring. And these little adjustments have given us some room to not lose money while still being able to keep our caregivers happy. We do give like holiday gifts, gift cards, but that actually comes out of our budget. So I think we really liked Debbie's. I think everyone liked Debbie's suggestion. We're all going to go back and talk about that later, because that's amazing.
I think it's
And with the range and rate, it's more so not because we can't staff it like for reasons, but because there's something about their request that makes it more challenging, so that they can acknowledge that if it's very few hours, few days in the week, something not attractive to a caregiver,
or like a weekend case, right? Saturday and Sunday,
right? Certainly if somebody wants like one day a week or something.
I'd
like the idea of you guys offering the client to pay the $2 extra, you know, to get a caregiver to come on those off moments from times. That's good. Do other people do that? Or is that?
Well, we've heard of other agencies that charge more on weekends or more on undesirable shifts.
Right. I think it's smart to do that.
They charge more because they have to pay more.
Yeah.
Debbie, you had a comment.
Yeah, no, I would love to see sort of your pay structure and in terms of that, if you, or what you,
it's so
ballparks, right? I know you.
Yeah, like, yeah. It's like kind of haphazard, and we just like, and then we review every month to make sure we're okay.
But the other thing I was about what Natasha said, and I don't know if the rest of you are experiencing this, and I don't know if our Canadian friends are experiencing this, but we get folks, not just that they're getting offered more, but we have to pay them enough to make it worth them being off of unemployment. So if your rate, they do the math.
Yeah, they're not admitting it to us.
Right.
How do you,
yeah, I had a woman actually give me a spreadsheet of like, well, if I take unemployment, I get this much plus the extra $300 from every month from the government.
So why should I work for you?
$1,550 in order for, I was like, $1,550.
Right. Plus, I need to leave the house and go work. I could be sitting home and doing taking care of my family or whatever else I need to do.
For sitting on
you
my
really couch. Can't compete with it. How can we compete with it? That's why there's a shortage.
Right. And that's why we're in overtime, because the ones who are willing to work are already work too. But so I don't know if that's part of how the Canadian government has compensated folks. I just know for us, whenever they announce, I love that people are getting stimulus and all that, but it means people call off their shifts. It means people don't work. Now they're getting their tax refund and a stimulus.
We're going to have no one working.
We're on unemployment. So Marissa, Natasha, and I are all going to be wiping tushes for the next.
We're going to go do the shifts.
Well, they're also going to be getting that child tax credit on a monthly basis too, if they have children. Oh, so that's going to be another impact that's going to be starting, that we're going to see through the entire year, starting as of July through December.
You know, it's substantial. If we need to really, it just brings up an interesting, worthwhile topic of like, if any of us belong to, like, we belong to the Home Care Association of Florida, you know, like advocacy groups and legislatively, active in advocacy groups, because we joke about this, we hope for the best, we do what we can for our clients, but it's really a bigger problem. The problem is that the underclass has been the caregiving group, we need a solution for that, because then of course we want there to be social structures that help people in the lowest income categories. But then when now that group of people doesn't exist to do the jobs that have been done, who's going to do them? And if that means that raising, you know, they're fighting raising the minimum wage while also giving out more unemployment and benefits. And there's going to be entire segments of industries that are lacking employees, workers.
But don't forget the fine line. If they make too much, then they lose their child care voucher.
Absolutely right.
They work too many hours.
Right, because we're paying on the books, and then their unemployment is documented.
You know, it's a very, I agree with you. I would like to see us, maybe something we can talk about next time, is advocacy. Like, who are the people we should be talking to? What are the things we should be following so that we are aware of
what? So we have, NJHSA has a Washington representative who advocates for various issues. And let me bring this to her. I could have Debbie, we could set up a meeting if you want. Does anyone want to be in that meeting with this representative, Darcy Hirsch, to talk about what issues you are thinking they would advocate for? What?
Yes. Or we could invite her to one of our next meetings.
Sure. Do you want me? Would you rather me do that and everyone can talk about
that
it?
That would be great.
Yeah, minutes? I think that would be helpful.
Okay. Done. Okay.
Can I ask who on this call serves Medicaid or does any home community-based services?
So we don't do Medicaid, but we do Holocaust.
Okay.
Survivors, so we get money from the conference, but we don't, but that's through our Jewish Family Service, but we don't.
Israeli, you don't? Huh. I think Jessa does, and they're normally on this call and they're not here now. Do you know the Jewish Social Service Agency, Andrea?
No, I don't.
Washington, in Maryland.
In Washington. I could, if you're interested in talking to someone who knows about that, I can hook you two up after this meeting. I'll send an email and connect you.
Yeah, there's a lot of funding coming out through the jobs infrastructure, so to speak, and the American Rescue Plan. And we're talking, Virginia's scheduled to get like $216 million that will go to home and community-based services. So it's going to provide a huge pay increase for Medicaid workers and Medicaid reimbursement rates, which is now going to start impacting private pay because we're going to have to pay them even higher. And there's just a lot. And I work with the Virginia Association for Home Care and Hospice. And we are doing a great deal of lobbying and trying to figure out how to get these funds and the best ways to do them. But we're just seeing a lot of that because we have that community-based, and then the 60% is private pay. So I find myself, like you, Marissa, doing the exact same things. Those clients that want specific caregivers, they pay the overtime. Clients that they may want a caregiver that they've had before, but that caregiver is working for another client 40 hours. So they have to pay that employee's overtime, even though they're not working for them. Mm-hmm. We have a waiting list right now, even for our private pay, because there's so many agencies that can't do it. And even if we could pay the overtime and bill the overtime, we just don't have the staff. So it's not really about the being able to do it or not. It's about having the actual caregivers. And we did receive a $10,000 foundation fund that we use specifically to, if people don't have transportation, but they want to work, we'll Uber them, Lyft them, taxi them to their jobs. And if it was a Medicaid waiver client, you know, we might have to put somebody in overtime because Medicaid doesn't reimburse us. But we're doing a lot of the same things. Our Medicaid employees actually just all received a $1,500 bonus from Medicaid. Mm. But that only went to Medicaid workers. It did not go to private pay workers. It was strictly for those workers. So your private pay workers get a little upset when that happens, but that's nothing we can control. But we're doing a lot of the same things here in the Virginia area. It's all customized. We look at the demands, where the clients are located, the types of caregivers they might be requesting. We're saying a minimum of 4 hours. So if they only want two, they're going to pay for four. Mm-hmm. We have to pay our caregivers at least 4 hours of time to make it worth their while. Yeah. That's just a little bit here. We deal with a lot of different pieces of that.
How big is your program or your?
Right now I have 92 clients. I would probably about 38 of those are the Medicaid clients, the rest are private pay. And the hours do vary. We're seeing more of an increase in hours than a decrease. Plus, we have several waiting.
Yeah.
Some of the more difficult clients that are private pay, we're like, maybe we need to look at the more simpler clients that are sitting in our queue waiting to get those that care, because we're spending a lot of additional care management time on a lot of our clients because they need more than they needed prior to the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I bet that's increasing all over.
Yeah.
Clients, and there's a lot more anxiety and.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have a question. I think Debbie might have answered part of it as far as what she's doing to recruit caregivers, but I was wondering if anyone here has come up with creative ways to work on recruiting caregivers.
Creative. I don't know if this is creative. We have contacts in the different colleges, like where they get certifications. So we have, you know, people, let's say, who have international students coming to get a designation who have to do some co-op work. So they'll send us their students and we'll interview them to see if they're suitable to do work in our program. And then we have a contact with the Filipino community resources, and she will send us some applicants. Trying to think if there's any. So we have several colleges that offer like registered care designations.
Good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Community colleges, I guess, or.
Yeah, they started marketing to the nursing schools.
Right.
That's right. The nursing schools. And then there's also immigration services. Sometimes we will get applicants from there. And then there's all the, you know, community centers, churches, pre-pandemic. Community centers, churches, synagogues, We put, you know, advertisements on the premise so people can see it. Sometimes we would do even, well, schools, but not during the pandemic. There could be mothers who, you know, want to work for a few hours a day just to supplement their income. Yeah.
I'm imagining from there, they probably have to get their credentials and you have some.
Well, not everyone has to have a credential in our program. It depends what kind of work.
Depends.
If you're doing personal care, you do. But if you're if you're cleaning and cooking, you don't.
Okay. So you do provide homemaking. Okay.
Israella, you have a program. And didn't you train people to provide the services, certify them or something?
Yeah, we have a home companion training program right now. We've actually missed our third session because of COVID. We've been trying to put that online. So actually, once we do that, we're well into putting our training program online. We actually hope that we'll get a different educated population that'll actually know how to work a computer, a laptop or whatever. We'll be able to Zoom stuff like that. A lot of what you're talking about doesn't necessarily apply to us because we are a registry. We don't bonus. I don't get a bonus. They don't get a bonus. Nobody gets bonuses around here. We just want to follow, as somebody earlier said, the Fair Labor Standard Act, the FLSA. We want to make sure that the families, if God forbid somebody ever looks into it, that they're applying the minimum wage. Here in Connecticut, what's interesting is in August, the minimum wage is going to go up again. So that means that our rates are going to have to go up as the recommended rates that the families should pay the aides. But beyond that,
curiosity, what is your minimum wage?
Okay, right now in Connecticut, I think it's around 12, and the rate that our companions are at 13. Our CNAs get 16. So in August, when it goes up that other dollar, and that will go up a dollar, so that then our companions, just companions, will make 14, and then the others will go up 17. We feel that we need to be above minimum wage. And we do have a minimum of the 2 hours. But it's very rare that somebody would only need 2 hours. And sometimes it's just right for somebody to scooch in and scooch out to another job. Mm-hmm. So
how many clients do you service with your registry?
Right now in its total private pay, we don't accept Medicare, Medicaid, any of that. We don't have an agreement with SWCA. And because it's private pay and the aides need to get paid, we don't have any agreements with anybody because, you know, like the Holocaust survivors, we can't take the money from the blue card or stuff like that. So my families, all of them private pay around 70 right now, which is a little low for us. We usually run at least 10, sometimes as much as 15 clients a month. That's 70 clients a month. We'll probably hit twice as that for the whole year.
Right.
We've been able to maintain ourselves throughout the COVID situation. But we have about 120 aides assigned somewhere. So we just monitor ins and outs, and as the intakes, you know, who wants the job. We have a ClearCare. That's the computer program that we broadcast the jobs. So we're not necessarily going to the churches or, you know, putting ads out for clients or aides for that matter. A lot of it is just word of mouth.
So interesting. Do any of you in your communities have registries? Because if only you were in some of these communities, you could solve a lot of their problems. You know, registry is a good idea, but it's hard to find the people, I imagine.
Yeah.
But is it really then a service, Israel, or do you make any money? Your agency make money as a registry?
We bring in over $400,000 a year. We make money. We support our home department as well as the rest of the agency.
It's amazing. They make
money because of the spread between what the client, they collect the money on behalf of the caregiver from the client. Isn't it like that?
Not exactly. No. They have to pay the aid directly. We can't pay the aid.
So they pay you a referral fee.
Any ideas that that these aids work for us, which is why there's no bonus.
Right.
Pay the aides directly.
How do you get the money? How do you make money?
We bill a referral for a companion an additional $3.25 or $4 an hour above what they pay the aid.
A separate referral service bill or something.
It's ongoing.
Right.
It's ongoing indefinitely. Families don't necessarily like that, but that's how we make our money. I have a client that's been with us 20 years. Still pay it.
In Florida, they don't do that. In Florida, they take that risk and they are the collect. They have like a separate escrow account and they have it somehow set up so that it has the appearance that they're collecting the pay on behalf of the caregiver for the client. And the difference is theirs to keep.
Referral thing. It's a way to do it as being an administrator, but that's.
I like your way. It's more straightforward and honest.
It's very clean. It's very clean.
Except you stand to lose when they lie and say the person's not working for them anymore.
Right.
Yes, exactly right.
I don't have enough hours in my life. There's a number of times where I want to get in the car and drive over to the client because I just know the caregiver's there.
Right.
And I never do it because what am I going to do in the end anyway?
Yeah. Well, I have to say that truthfully, the only time that's happened is when the family actually has the money to pay our fee and has decided that, I'm a donator to JFS. I don't have to pay these bills. I'm going to donate.
Huh.
But the equity is not always equal. But it doesn't happen as much. Most people are pretty, they're not happy about it.
Yeah.
But they do usually pay our bills.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. We're a little different, but we manage. And so far, we're good. And I'm sorry, it's a time when we're eating lunch, so I don't think you need to see me eating anything. So I go down.
That's fine.
Israela, it's just what we're doing here.
Israela, is your training course, is it like for fee? The caregivers have to pay for this?
No, but that's the only way they become a part of our registry. They have to take the class. It's actually 3 hours twice a week over 7 weeks. So it's 40 hours of in-classroom training.
Mm-hmm.
That in-classroom. Okay, so we missed the last three. Mm-hmm. So now it's going to be on Zooming. We may try to consolidate. It's different when you're in person. You got to say, okay, let's take a break, go to the bathroom, get something to drink. Now people are going to be home. And so we're going to consolidate. Maybe it'll be 6 weeks instead of 7 weeks, but there is a lot of materials to cover. In terms of the cost, we never charge them actually for the class. We do have to do a criminal background check, so they pay for it separately. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also there's a textbook that we charge them $20 for, and that's it. $32, mm-hmm. people are happy to do it, except it means that they're not going to get a job until 7 weeks from now.
Right. People, I think it's great.
They want to work, and we say, sorry, Charlie.
And they're not
still, they take the class. Uh-huh. Even CNAs who have that state licensing, they still must take our in-home training program.
Okay, but wow. The caregivers are not get paid for the time they is no. just there. Yeah. No. Okay.
Exactly right.
Good. Do you think you can teach it remotely to Canadian folks?
No, when we finally get it online, you're welcome to join us.
Yeah, okay, let's keep in touch.
Oh, absolutely, it'll be interesting.
Is it too?
Actually a good idea for other agencies if you can do it. It seems like it's a moneymaker, but probably got its own headaches too.
We just recently received an anonymous donation from a donor for $46,000. And what we're doing with that is they have asked that we do online PCA training. Fortunately, we're members of VOC, as I mentioned earlier, and they offer a online training, personal care aid certification program that we will do. And I think it's $99 a caregiver. And then we will provide with our director of nursing the 8 hours of clinical training and skills training, because we do have a skills testing site here at JFS. We are licensed under the Virginia Department of Health to do PCA training. We've done several on site, but because of the pandemic, we need to go online, and we did not have an online platform. So we will start doing that. In fact, we are meeting tomorrow to develop the plan and how that $46,000 is going to get people in. We may even pay them to take the class because we need caregivers that badly. And when we do some of the other ones that we received donations or funds for, was strictly for poverty-stricken areas where the donors wanted to help people get on their feet and get into the job market. We had to pay for childcare for them to come, stipends, so they could come into the class. We bought uniforms for them. So we're doing a lot of that and have done that. But it was wonderful to get the email yesterday from our CEO that an anonymous donor gave us the funds to be able to do this particular program. So we're very excited about hoping to come up with something good to attract some good caregivers and retain them.
It's terrific.
How long is your program, Andrea? The training, the PCN's program?
The training is, it's 48 hours. It has to be 40 total, according to the Virginia Department of Health. Mm-hmm. We do add 8, sometimes 16 additional hours, depending on the level or the caliber of the caregivers that are coming in at that time that we're training, and if they need more skills type training versus.
How many are in a class generally?
The last class we did in person was 15.
And if you do it on Zoom, you're going to keep it to 15 or get as many as you can?
We on Zoom, the online class is online. So they go through the curriculum at their pace.
Oh.
The 8 hours will be done at the agency.
I gotcha.
And then that's how that will work. It is an actual online. There are probably, I would say right now in Virginia, I have for-profit competition, and I know 9 of them right now are doing all online PCA training.
Well, that's a lot of competition. 9 agencies?
9. I have 72 within a 40-mile radius.
Wow. That's a lot of competition.
It's crazy. And we're all fighting for the same 11 hospitals, all the same physicians. It really is.
Yeah, that sounds really hard.
Yeah, it's a challenge, but it's a good one. And we're good at what we do. And if they're not as good, then they just don't stand out. So,
yeah. Well, I think this is potentially a good time to wrap it up. Did anyone want to say anything about when our next meeting is? Does anyone know? I do.
It's June 3rd is our next meeting. We'll send a reminder out. We'll discuss whether or not we think, or depending on when Darcy, the advocacy director, is available, whether we want to add it to our June 3rd meeting, or if we can just make it a time that works for her and invite whoever's free that day. I almost hate to wait till June, but we all have, you know, so many of us are attending the conference next week, and May's a busy time. So,
and Darcy will be there, of course. So, might not be the best time to, you know, we could see, we'll play it by ear. I'll definitely bring it up with her. Yeah.
And then again, remember just to recruit if you meet any other home care folks while you're at the conference, or, you know, it would just
send us an email if you have ideas about what you'd like to discuss next time, like over the next month or so. If things come up, things change.
That's great.
If you think of anything.
Well, I thought this was a good meeting.
We don't have a solution. The only thing we can do is
every small
fundraise
group
from our families. Debbie, thank you.
Right.
Yeah. Send that letter. That's the most important thing. Okay, great. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Enjoy spring.
Thank you.
Bye.